Hi, I'm Nick Gregoretti's, and this is the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast, the show for grapplers and martial artists that want to evolve both on and off the mat.
Greetings from Northern California, everyone. I am in Mendocino, the little town of Mendocino, which is in Mendocino County. I'm at my buddy's place out in the woods here. It's a beautiful sunny day, and it is incredibly picturesque. It's such a wonderful place. This is where I come to recharge. It's been a pretty wild roller coaster of a ride my first half a year living in the United States. There have been some days when I'm so happy that I made that decision, and other days when I've been cursing myself and wishing I hadn't. This is one of the points where I'm just happy to be here, happy to be alive, and I wanted to share that with you guys. Coming up now is episode 51 of the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood podcast, which is Jay Valco, super smart, super philosophical jiu-jitsu player, and we get into a fantastic chat about a little bit of politics, a little bit of jiu-jitsu, and some other stuff. Before we dive into the show, I just want to remind you guys, you can support the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood, including this podcast, by heading on over to jiu-jitsubrother.com and clicking on the store link, clicking on the podcast link. We've got all sorts of options for you guys. If you want to support us on Patreon, you can do that. If you want to subscribe to our online academy, which is what I believe to be one of the best online academies in the world, you can do that and use the coupon code podcast and get 10% off. You can head on over to the store and you can get any one of our fantastic gis, including the Seeker gi, and get 10% off using the coupon code. Again, it's podcast. Also, if you want to try some CBD oil and you're in the UK, head on over to truthnaturals.co.uk and use the code JJBTruth and you'll get a discount on that. Okay, guys, let's dive in to episode 51, Jay Valco. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood show, and I'm here with Jay Valco, and I was just telling him that is one of the coolest names I've ever heard. There's just something awesome sounding about it. Sounds like some sort of Viking tribal leader, a warrior class, the Valco clan. Thanks for coming on the show, Jay.
Thanks for having me. With the Valco last name, it's actually funny that it invokes that kind of thing, because I'm not any Viking or Scandinavian descent at all, but my wife is, and our kids have very Danish names.
Okay.
Valco is like a Slavic name.
Is it really, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, when I met you, now that you tell me it's Slavic, I can believe it, because you're a proper unit, dude. You're a big man.
It's biggish.
Thanks. Yeah, and you know how those guys are over there in Eastern Europe. It's just literally like a different breed of human being. They're all monstrously big. I'm not sure if you've been out there, but...
I haven't. The last name is about as far as it goes for me culturally.
Fair enough.
I did last year one of those... Ancestry.com DNA test. And I came back, my whole life actually thought I was mostly Irish, but according to this thing, I'm mostly English. So that was interesting.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I mean, I'm a bit concerned about when those Eastern European people all, when like 10 or 20 years, when jiu-jitsu is really established there, I think we're all going to be in trouble, because they're just absolute monsters, like especially with regards to bone structure. They're just huge, monstrous dudes. They're all basically built like Roger.
I'm sure jiu-jitsu is going to get a lot meaner at that point when those guys take over.
Yeah, I always joke that, like, when I see a huge dude on the mat, I'm like, damn, jiu-jitsu is supposed to protect us from dudes like you. I don't want to teach him too much, right?
It's all other things being equal. You know, when people say, like, oh, size or strength doesn't matter, it's When everything else is equal, size and strength matters a lot.
Hell yeah. That is so true. So true. As a big guy, do you find yourself questioning whether what you did would have worked against someone of your own size and strength when you're sparring against someone who's maybe not as physically imposing as you?
Yeah, sometimes. So the other day I was sparring with a purple belt we got who... I mean, I'm maybe big-ish. I'm about 6 feet, 230. But this guy's, I think, 6'4", 5", 350.
Wow.
And it was just, there's not much I can do at all. We call him the tree. His name is Tim the Tree, and he's just a beast of a human being. So when you go with someone that size, it's all the whole size doesn't matter thing gets thrown out the window very quickly.
You know, there's still some people out there who their minds just literally cannot process that. They cannot accept that size and strength can overcome technical knowledge or technical ability. I remember I put up an article called The Biggest Lie in Jiu-Jitsu on my site, and I posted it on Reddit. And, you know, I received a lot of comments, but there was this one where this guy literally spent maybe 1,500 words justifying why that wasn't true. And it was a real sign to me that it was an example to me of how when the human mind is deluded, it can create the most detailed fantasies to support its delusion. Yeah.
It's the story, you know, it's the story that we all tell ourselves about the myths that we've been fed and that we believe and that, you know, things like that. And you see it across all the martial arts. Jiu-Jitsu is, we're relatively lucky in that we get to like kind of test our theories every day. But some of these other martial arts where you can't even test it, they can go on with these strange delusions for their whole life, you know?
Yeah, I know. I always say that a lot of the like traditional martial arts, or a lot of the traditional martial arts, I classify them under the umbrella phrase, which is one of the biggest cons ever foisted upon the Western world in the 20th century. Obviously, I'm not referring to all traditional martial arts because I think some of them have value, but a large portion of them just total bullshit. I mean, there's just no other way to put it.
Well, it really does make you think about the way people can just be very intelligent, analytical, whatever, but then you can just spot their weaknesses, whether it's martial art or some other thing, where you're like, God, how can you be so advanced thinking in so many areas and then have this straight weakness, you know? And I have plenty of my own that somebody else can look at me and be like, how can you believe blah, 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 when, you know?
100%. I think in psychology, they're called cognitive biases or cognitive dissonances. And I think there's a list of something like 50 or 60 of them. Like one of them is recency bias, whereby you give preference to information that you received more recently than older information. And there's a list, a whole list of them. And I once went through it and I was astounded to, you know, upon reflecting, I realized how many of them I had succumbed to and was still succumbing to. And it was pretty sobering.
Especially if you're engaging in arguments on Reddit or Facebook or whatever, sometimes I can literally feel myself blown, like being this bias, and then I'll stop myself and be like, all right, like it's so easy to just get drawn in and go to your defenses, you know?
And there's something I found that's very interesting is when you've been observing your mind for long enough, you start to realize that it is naturally confrontational, and it will, I see it with the people I interact with a lot. They'll make an argument and I'll find myself just holding the other viewpoint up just because it's just my mind's tendency. And eventually I'll be like, why am I doing this? I don't even believe this. It's just that natural, if the person says X, I'm going to say Y.
Totally. I'm a natural contrarian, and it's, maybe there's something that attracts people with minds like that to jiu-jitsu or something. It's hard to say because a lot of people I meet are kind of like that. They just like going to the opposite side, sometimes just for no reason. Like I'll waste time just counterpointing somebody. Just for me, it's just kind of fun. It exercises my mind, but then you just got to make sure to see the difference between when you're doing it for the mental exercise and when you're doing it just when you're almost convincing yourself, like you're like, I don't really think this, but I'm starting to feel like I think it, you know, that's like a weird way to be.
Just basically not investing yourself in it. And I think that's what I find very difficult about the current zeitgeist, especially in the United States, the political era, the political zeitgeist, which is, you know, you'll have these guys like Jordan Peterson debating guys like Sam Harris, and they've each got their own viewpoint, and I could sit there listening to both of them, and after each of their argument, I'm convinced that they're correct. And it shows me that, you know, both are correct and neither are correct. And investing too much in either stance is always, to me, a sign that you've missed. You've missed it. It's when you're like, okay, this is my decision. This is my viewpoint. I'm planting my flag in the sand. And from now on, this will be my perspective. Because, you know, one of the best pieces of advice I was ever given by a very smart man, he said, everyone's perspective is different, but the perspective should always be shifting. If you're an open-minded person, your perspective will not stay constant for very long, because as you're exposed to new information, you have to start shifting your perspective to account for that new information. And I don't always get it right, but that is something I really try to do, is just realize that as soon as I have an opinion, that's when I've missed it.
Right. Well, and what's also hard, like the example you gave, the Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris, I listen to these guys too. There's about, I don't know, eight podcasts or so I usually go through in a week. But I think it's a limited learning platform. It's good to get a very good superficial understanding of something. And when you have a superficial understanding of everything, that's when it all sounds so convincing. But when you, if you like take the time to dig into like several books on a topic, then you can ground your understanding a little bit better, but also realize how much you don't know. You know, for me, like I'm a big reader and a big audiobook listener. And it's really is true what they say, like the more you know, the more you realize you don't know.
I 100%.
Think a humbling experience to that.
I think that's tied into another expression, or it dovetails with another expression, which is a little bit of knowledge is a very dangerous thing.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, these other people talking about the political zeitgeist, a lot of people, you have to be very careful, use it to their advantage to manipulate people. So I see all the time, like in my Facebook feed, thread will come up like a sponsored thread by some conservative or some liberal or whatever. And they're like, are you sick of hearing this from the other side? Well, here's some ammo for you. Bang, 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 bang. You know? And it's like, it builds a straw man of the other side, and then it breaks it down, and it does it so short and so convincing that if you're only tuned into that, it is going to win you over. And then it's just going to create polarization. And I think a lot of these people, I think some like I think Sam Harris, even though I sometimes don't agree with a lot of what he says, I think he truly is coming through this with a good faith effort to expand the understanding of some people. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. A lot of these podcasters are coming with an effort to convince you of something to because they're a brand and they're selling themselves as a brand.
I mean, yeah, a friend of mine, Gerald, who's a very smart man, very, very intelligent man, he's really got his finger on the pulse of this whole thing. I mean, my wife was listening to Jordan Peterson. She got into this weird bubble of just listening to him for like 2 or 3 weeks, every single thing of every clip of his on YouTube and every podcast, to the point where like it was kind of driving me out of my mind a little bit. But you know, I did find a lot of his stuff very, very good, and he's obviously incredibly intelligent, and he makes these fantastic arguments and tells stories and anecdotes in a very, very good way. But there was just something about it. There was just something about it. I couldn't put my finger on it, that it just didn't sit with me the right way. And then Gerald told me that the guy's making 80 grand a month on Patreon. And what he was saying is, look, whenever there's a financial element involved, there is usually some sort of manipulation. And true enough, it turns out that this argument that he's making, that Canada has become so liberal and left-leaning that you cannot call someone by their pre-transgender name without being arrested and thrown in jail and having your reputation tarnished. I mean, it turns out that's bullshit. Like, there definitely is a lot of liberal stuff happening, and the laws have changed, but it's nowhere near as severe or intense as Jordan Peterson has made it out to be to further his agenda. And
that understanding of that situation is that the law was you could get like fined or something, and then the way Peterson presented it was you can go get arrested. And he was following the logic chain of what happens if you don't pay the fine and then you refuse, yada, yada, yada. But yeah, no, I totally hear what you're saying. Another good example, and you know, like Ben Shapiro is really in right now. And I like listening to Ben Shapiro. He's a, you know, big voice for the conservative side or whatever. But he put out this video for PragerU, which is, you know, you've probably seen. And he talks about intersectionality and how it creates victim status and all this stuff. And you watch it and you're like, wow, yeah, that's just absurd, blah, blah, blah. But then I went and watched the TED Talk of the person who came up with intersectionality, and her explaining it made it seem a lot more reasonable. And that's not to give an opinion on intersectionality. That doesn't matter for my point. My point is that if you're going to listen to some person on either side, I generally recommend at least doing a quick Google search to see the arguments against what they're presenting.
I think that's such wise advice. And you know, it's so easy to convince yourself of something or have yourself convinced of something. I see it happening all the time. Like, I really have to keep that little handbrake or that emergency brake on my psyche when I start to go down a rabbit hole or a thought tunnel, and it's something I haven't always been able to pull off.
Well, it's comforting to be to have a feeling that you know how it works, right? Like, it's like you're like, oh man, it just makes so much sense. This is why yada 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 yada. But then the more you learn about it, you're like, God damn it, it's more nuanced than that. And that's kind of uncomfortable because there is often no just easy explanation for why this person thinks that or why this group does that or whatever.
And it's one of the pitfalls of, or pitfall maybe isn't the correct word. It's one of the cons or the negative aspects of being alive in the modern age where we have all these wonderful things like quality medicine and, you know, dwellings and plumbing and vehicles and all these wonderful things that technology and society and civility have brought us. But I think one of the biggest negatives is in this information age, we're presented with too much knowledge. And there comes a point where a couple of years ago, I started thinking about this concept, which I called true sight, or the gift of true sight, capital T, capital S, which was I pictured it as the ability to see right through to the heart of the matter. So if, hypothetically speaking, you were watching two hyper-intelligent men such as Jordan Peterson and Ben Shapiro having an argument or a discussion or a discourse, you could just be able to have this instinct that would just allow you to see the truth of each person's argument and be able to separate the wheat from the chaff on both sides, which I think is ultimately that is wisdom. That wisdom would give you the ability to discern. And, you know, I'm reminded of the story of the dude in the Bible, King Solomon, who's supposedly the wisest man who ever lived. You know, that story, which I thought was, dude, it's such a powerful story where some woman has these two women of similar age. They're both living together and they both have a baby at the same time. And then the one woman's baby, she smothers it in the night accidentally. And then she claims that the living baby is actually hers, and she creates this case. She goes to King Solomon and she says, oh, that woman's got my baby. Her baby died, not mine, and I want it back. And then he listens to both sides of the story and he says, okay, well, I'll tell you what, we'll cut the baby in half and give half to her and half to you. And the real mother says, no, don't worry, just give the baby to the other woman. And his wisdom allows him to see, okay, actually that was really her child, because she would not want any harm to come to it. So she just offered it up. And I'm coming in a really roundabout way to my point, which is I'd love to be able to have that kind of discernment in the modern age, whereby I could just put on Jordan Peterson or someone else and just know straight away how much of it is just hyper theorized intellectual bullshit and how much of it is just truth. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. And it's very hard. And you know, what doesn't help is the pundits. I mean, I don't want to just like say the media, because it'll sound like I'm just bashing the media. But like, for example, I read this book. It's called Human Action. It's a big economics book, pretty old, from a guy named Ludwig von Mises. And I just finished reading the book, and then this article popped up in my Facebook feed from some like liberal news source like Slate or Salon or something. And it was trying to claim that Mises was a racist. And then it quoted this section from Human Action, which I had literally just read. And the book was saying the opposite of the way the article was trying to frame it. You know? And I know that this reporter or whatever the person was didn't sit there and read all 800 pages of that book. They probably did some kind of, you know, Google ad word search and tried to manipulate it or whatever. But nobody's going to fact check that article and go and read the book, right? It's like, so it's so easy to just manipulate people with these little op-eds and these whatever you want to call it. And it's tough. Like you said, too much information. And you know, anyone can find what they're looking for. If you want to prove that someone is a this kind of person or that person, you just Google it and some article will show up confirming what you're trying to show. Mm-hmm.
And that's tied into another point that or an idea that I've been considering a lot lately, which is I can never remember who it was. I've been trying for years, but I once read a little excerpt about a particular philosopher who read himself insane. That was the line. He read himself insane. And I just cannot remember the name of the philosopher. If you know it, I'd appreciate it. But it just made me realize that, you know, like if you take a book, for example, like, I don't know, you could read, hypothetically speaking, Mein Kampf, right? And, right. You know, that comes from it's something that's been projected from a very powerful mind, albeit a sick mind or a deluded mind. And either way, that can have a very transformative effect on your psyche. And I guess it's tied into this gift of true sight. Like, you could read an amazing book and it can change the way you look at the world, but how do you know it's changing it correctly and changing it along a line that's going to benefit you, if that makes sense? And it could be an incredible book. It could be well written and present this amazing argument, but you don't ever really know just where that's going to take you, if that makes sense.
Totally. And I think another thing that happens, and we can, this can tie back into the martial arts, but I think often the first thing that you're really exposed to, like most people kind of formulate their musical tastes and their political opinions and kind of their personality, like in their late teens and early 20s, and they don't change it a whole lot. So like maybe you're a young person and you start watching a certain news channel, or you just read a couple books by a certain person, and then that's basically your opinions from then forward, and you're defending them from there on. And I think, you know, this kind of happens with the martial arts. We're talking about somebody, like when I was younger, I did traditional martial arts. I did something that was called, it changed names in the middle of it. It used to be called Um Yung Do, and then it became something else, but it claimed to be the combination of 8 different martial arts, like Aikido, Hapkido, Judo, Japanese Jiu-Jitsu, Kung Fu, all this stuff. And I bought into it. I thought it was legit, you know, and I could see how when I started watching the UFC in the late 90s, I was like, man, this doesn't look anything like what I'm doing, you know. And then I would go to the instructor and tell him, like, you know, this doesn't look like that. And he's like, well, you know, they're not allowed to eye gouge, and they're not allowed to hit in the balls, and or whatever. All these excuses. You could just rattle off excuse about why what we were learning didn't look like what I thought real fighting looked like, you know. And I think as I started to – my eyes started to open, and I started to move away from that martial art, I would, you know, see other people that had no – just didn't want to watch UFC, just wanted to pretend that what they were doing was legit. And it's tough. It's tough to have your reality shattered like that. But that was kind of my move away from traditional martial arts and into jiu-jitsu. And I'd like to think I can stay relatively open-minded about fields larger than martial arts, some of this other stuff we're talking about, and if I'm convinced that I could move in a certain direction.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to think so too. I'm starting to wonder if
My wife said something to me yesterday, which we actually got into a bit of an argument over. She just said, people don't change. And I wonder if there is still that flexibility within the psyche. Okay, let's take a guy like Sean Hannity, right? Who, yeah. I don't want to make this an overly political conversation. I don't really care about politics one way or another, and I'm just watching it as a spectator. I haven't committed to either side, but this guy is
a podcast and not ultimately talk about the big things right now.
exactly. So this is for those of you who aren't in the U.S. and haven't been following U.S. politics, this guy runs hosts a show on Fox, which is a pretty right-leaning conservative TV station or television station. And he's pretty opinionated and he's very right-wing and outspoken, right? And on the other end of the spectrum, we could take John Oliver or John Stewart, who are the liberal left-leaning counterparts. I wonder if it would even be possible if you sat either one of those guys down and presented them with the most congruent, illuminating, well-argued counterpoints to their stance. I wonder if they would even be able to see it, you know, if they would even be able to like accept and form that, I call it the chink in the armor. When I talk to very religious people, I'm always looking for that little chink in the armor that I can find if they want to take the conversation there. I'm like, okay, cool. Then let's find that little crack where like some real or some new information can get in, because when you take such a solid position or stance on something, you're basically building this fortress in your psyche that you don't allow to be assailed by new information or new knowledge. And I'm just wondering if the average person can ever let anything through, anything new through.
So there's this book I read a few years ago called The Myth of the Rational Voter. It's by an economist named Brian Kaplan. And he came up with this idea of rational irrationality. And basically, people often are irrational when it comes to their beliefs or their voting patterns or whatever, because they have a preference for that irrationality. It makes them feel good. It helps them understand who they are. So it's rational in that sense to be irrational. And they also generally, the cost of being irrational in that sense is very low. Like you can go and vote for some crazy thing. Your one vote isn't going to sway the election. And the only thing it costs you is the 5 minutes inconvenience of waiting in line and going to do it. And same thing with crazy political or religious beliefs or whatever. The cost is low, but the value you get from it internally can be relatively high. Whereas if you do something different, like the cost of being irrational when it comes to like driving on the right side of the road or something can be very high, right? So people don't do it. Yeah. So I think it's an interesting way to look through it. You just have to see that there's a preference for being a certain kind of person.
Mm. That I really like that it's opened up something in my mind, that idea of what does it cost you? What is the cost of irrationality? And I think one of the yardsticks you can use is just success is a really good yardstick for that. Because if you're irrational in your attempt at achieving whatever you're trying to achieve, you just won't achieve the desired result, right? Let's say you want to become a black belt in jiu-jitsu and you just go do something irrational, like decide, oh, I'm never going to spar and I'm just going to do it this way by just reading jiu-jitsu books. You know, the result is going to be that you're not going to get where you're trying to go. You're not going to achieve your goal. So that to me is, you've just given me such a gift now, because I've realized that is the easiest way to figure out if I'm being, if my rationale is correct. I just have to look at what I'm trying to achieve and see if I've achieved it or not.
Well, people will just display it through behavior. So I remember like when Christopher Hitchens was still alive and he would get together with these other anti-religious bashers and they would be like, you know, this person believes, and they would list off some crazy religious belief, like, I'll just say an extreme example, that Odin is real or whatever. This person believes that Odin is real, but he still gets up and goes to work and has normal human relations. How can this be? How can he have such a crazy belief on the one end, but then act like a completely rational human on the other end? And I think it's just that the cost of believing in Odin is low, and it's just a preference, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's wild. I mean, this conversation hasn't exactly gone where I expected it to, but it's been very refreshing to enter into this kind of discourse with you, bud. Like, I'm not very educated when it comes to politics. I'm not very educated when it comes to psychology or any of these things we've been discussing. I'm a man of average intelligence, but I do enjoy discussing these things with people who are open-minded. And it's very, very cool that you could take it there. Yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah, no, it's my pleasure. And, I enjoy talking about these things and thinking about these things. And I would like to think it's not hard to talk about some of these things. You know, like, you and I have only met once in real life, and we can sit here and talk. We know that other people are going to listen, but we're not arguing or getting weird, you know?
Yeah, so. For sure. So, Jay, just because this is the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood show, and not the Politics Brotherhood show, I wanted to, you know, it's clear that you're a very smart man with some great viewpoints, and I'd want to get some of those viewpoints on jiu-jitsu. There's a very specific question that I wanted to ask you, but before I do, if you could just give the listeners some of your background on jiu-jitsu. It's my understanding you trained for over 5 years with Carlson Gracie Sr., if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, yeah. So it started, grew up in Florida. I was born in Chicago, but I grew up in Florida. Like I said, I was doing kind of traditional martial arts, started watching UFC, and I was like, just something's wrong here. I was still in high school at the time, I joined my high school wrestling team my senior year. So I was a little late to the party, but I got in one season. And I realized after, you know, a season of high school wrestling, which is about 3 months, I felt like I knew more about fighting than the previous several years of martial arts I took. So that was like a big eye opener for me. And then a guy named Eduardo De Lima moved to Florida and opened up a Gracie Baja there. It was one of, if not the first Gracie Bajas in the States, I think, or at least in Florida. This was around 99. So I met him, started training there. Got my blue belt there, stayed there for a few years. Then I moved to Chicago just from a strange set of circumstances got me back in Chicago. And looking for a school here, I went to the Carlson Gracie School, which was junior school with a guy named Jeff Neal and a couple other guys opened it. And just by pure luck, around the time I moved to Chicago, Carlson Sr. moved to Chicago.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, because this is where his son was. So he started teaching at the school, and I trained with him for 5 years until his death. And just luck, and it was great, you know. And then after he died, I stuck around Carlson's for a little while longer, but it was just, you know, without getting into too much detail, it just wasn't
the same.
Wasn't quite the same, and there was other issues going on, and I had a unique opportunity in that somebody literally offered me my own school, like building mats and everything.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
So I was like, yeah, I'll do it. So that's how Valka BJJ was born, essentially. And since I left Carlson's as a brown belt, I'd always stayed in touch with Eduardo. And when the time was right, he promoted me to black belt.
That's cool. What was it like? Carlson is someone I never had the pleasure of meeting or interacting with. All I really know is that they had quite a hard style, and his philosophy was his particular strain of jiu-jitsu was quite brutal and grinding and MMA oriented. Is that correct?
It's correct-ish. So I think that the reputation is a little exaggerated in that. When I came from a Gracie Baja background, I came from Eduardo's school, who was a very technical guard player. And when I did that at Carlson's, you know, I would do a lot of inverted guard and things like that. Carlson never discouraged it. He liked the way I played my guard. He liked the way I did everything. When he taught, and the moves that he taught were like kind of a old school grinding shoulder in the face style, but it's not like he wanted you just to fight that way. He was very open-minded as far as the, what tools you brought to the game.
I'm guessing he was a great coach.
Yeah, he was awesome. And he didn't speak English very well. And his coaching, I've tried to put my finger on it before, and I've tried to explain it in a different podcast and to my students, but there was an intangible about it. There was something in his heart and in his like soul that made you want to be a better jiu-jitsu competitor.
That's great. You know,
like, yeah, he like when he would coach me, he would not give me detailed instructions. He wouldn't tell me how much time was left. He barely spoke English. He might say, pass the guard, you know, or sweep or something. But that was all you needed. His passion for it was just really incredible. And I know that I have not gotten there in my coaching for other students. I think I'm a good coach and I inspire them to do well. And I hope so. But Carlson had something special that I still, after many years of thinking about it, have the trouble identifying.
Yeah, you know, things like that, I don't even know if they can be replicated. It's like, if it is what you mentioned, which is a specific soul, I think, is you said it was something in his soul, I doubt that that could ever be duplicated the same way, you know, like Roger Gracie's dad, Mauricio Gomez. He's just this really cool dude to be around, and he's like, everyone loves him, and he's just got this great, great vibe about him, and I don't think that anyone could sit down and analyze it and take it apart and then recreate it. I think it's just, yeah, it's just the soul, which is something, right. I guess.
Well, and Carlson's personality was very, straightforward, you know, like he didn't hide his emotions very much. And what you saw is what you got. Like, even to the day he died, it was kind of sad. If you brought up some of the old top team people like Alan Goes or whatever, he would just get stressed out. He would you could see him starting to get agitated and frustrated, and he would say, "I don't want to talk about this."
And you that's know? Because things ended sourly with those guys, or
yeah, these were when all the guys when he went out. I don't know if I have all the story correct, so sorry to anyone if I get it wrong. But as I understand it, he was living in California. All of his students in Brazil, I guess, got upset that they were under Carlson Gracie team, but he was in California. So that's when they formed Brazilian Top Team. And that was, you know, these original old school guys, Mario Sperry and Murilo Bustamante and these guys. And it just broke Carlson's heart. And I'm not taking sides on it. Maybe they're right to do that. He was living somewhere else. Maybe they weren't. But for him, just things like what he perceived as the correct amount of loyalty, and he didn't want money, anything like that, but he just wanted to be respected for what he built. And that was very crushing for him. But that kind of thing was also what made him such a passionate coach and these other things we talked about.
Mm-hmm. So. That's cool. I mean, I appreciate you illuminating me with some insight, because I didn't even know that story. So that it makes a lot of sense. I'd heard a little bit about his nature, and I guess, yeah, that would explain some of the things. Jay, I wanted to speak to you a little bit more about your jiu-jitsu journey, in particular when it comes to competing. You know, our mutual friend who introduced us, Lawrence Dunning, who's an excellent human being and a great black belt. I know he's a very close friend of yours as well. He explained to me that you competed a lot all the way up until brown belt, and then by the time you hit black belt, you were just a bit burnt out on it. Is that correct? Is that accurate?
Pretty much, yeah. I competed a ton at blue belt and purple belt and summer brown belt. I opened my school as a brown belt. And I guess I didn't realize when I opened the school how much that would affect my desire to compete. Essentially killed it.
Yeah.
And that's – so I have so much respect for some of these other – I mean, look at like – you know, in the Chicago area, like Comprito, for example, he's still out there doing all these tournaments and he runs a school. I don't know if he runs it full time or if he has other instructors or whatever, but man, that is so difficult. I basically just as I taught more and I was on the mat more, you know, 7 days a week, 2 to 3 times a day, private lessons, classes, I just couldn't find the fire to want to compete and train. And then there's also when you're going to compete, you have to be kind of selfish, right? Like you have to train hard and you have to go hard with your students. And when you're running an academy, you're always like got one eye on the room. You're making sure that nobody gets hurt and there's no drama and that, you know, the business is good and the mats are clean and everything. So it's very hard to have that more selfish part of your training. And I think that was part of it too.
No, I can totally, totally relate to that. What you said in particular was it was hard to find the fire. That just sums it up for me totally. It's you really, if you want to compete, I think you really do need to have, that is the word, fire. You need to have that like burning drive or desire to go out and put yourself out there. And if you don't, your training's just not going to be at the level to take you to where you need to be able to perform well.
Right. I've never fought MMA. And I remember people would ask me like, oh, are you ever going to fight MMA? Blah, blah, blah. This is like when I was like a lower belt, purple belt, brown belt. I was like, maybe when I get my black belt, I will. And I never, ever had a burning desire to fight MMA. I thought maybe I'd do it just because kind of jiu-jitsu people are supposed to do it and it'd be kind of cool to experience it once. But those aren't good reasons to get in a cage and exchange punches with somebody. You know what I'm saying? At least with jiu-jitsu, it's, I guess, safer and you can be more casual about it than MMA. So I still try to compete. I'm going to shoot for once a year. It's been only once every 2 years now. And when I decide I want to compete, often the thought process that goes through my mind is like, I haven't competed in a while. It would be good for me to have something to train for. And also the side effects that it makes you a better human being. It makes you overcome stress and things like that. Those are the reasons I compete. Not because like, I'm going to get a gold medal and I'm going to like kick some ass. That doesn't really enter my mind, you know?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. And I think you said it perfectly when you said it makes you a better human being. And I always say that I don't like competing. I don't enjoy it. I never step on the mat thinking, oh, this is so much fun and this is great and this is exactly where I'm supposed to be. I always dread it and I get anxiety and, you know, I don't particularly enjoy the act of doing it. However, I always leave that competition, win or lose, glad that I did it. It's just something I'm like, wow, that was good for me. I needed that.
And that's what I try to remind my students. I've basically never regretted competing. The longer you go without competing, kind of like the worse it is to get the ring rust.
Yeah, so true. Yeah.
Like I did the Nogi Worlds last year. It was my first tournament in 2 years. And I was more nervous than I had been. And when I used to compete a lot, like probably ever before, I was like, Jesus, what is like going on here? You know, I was like, it was hard for me to eat a couple days beforehand. And I was just like stressed. And then as soon as we got to the arena, all that was gone. My body was ready to fight and I felt good and competed well. It was a very good experience, but probably that 3 days before the day sucked.
Yeah, I hear you. I totally get you. Jay, my brother, we've actually gone, this is over 40 minutes. I usually keep the podcast around 30, but I was really enjoying, in particular, the political discussion at the beginning. So time really flew. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and your insight with us. And I do highly recommend Jay's school if you're in the Chicago area, Velko BJJ. I stopped by there on my tour of the Northeast recently and was very impressed by the not only Jay's skills, but also the students were all very cool and relaxed and there was a good vibe there. So Jay, if people want to come train with you, where should they go online to find out more about your stuff?
Yeah, so my website is just my last name, Valko, followed by BJJ.com. We are in Chicago, right outside the Loop. Visitors are always welcome. I'd love people in this Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood to come by.
Sure. Jay, my brother, thanks again so much for your time.
Thank you, Nick. I like what you're doing here, so good luck with your podcast.
I always feel so charged up after conversations like that. And Jay is clearly a very intelligent man. He gave me a lot of things to think about. And also a couple of those book recommendations are going straight to the top of my Amazon wish list. If you are in Chicago, I suggest checking out his school. It's really relaxed, good vibe, and he's a lovely human being as well. Okay, guys, that is it for this week on the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Show. Remember to check out our sponsors and also leave a review on iTunes, and I'll be back next week. Peace out.